This is episode 2 of the Index Ventures Creator Economy series. At Index, we believe that we're now entering a second renaissance, and this one's digital. Today, Index partner Sarah Cannon speaks with Paula Finlan, professor of history at Stanford University and the world's leading expert on the renaissance. In this fascinating discussion, they discuss parallels between the renaissance and today's modern technology-driven creator economy. Enjoy!
Paula, thank you very much for joining us today, our inaugural Creator Summit. So real pleasure to have you with us. We, in thinking about, some of my colleagues have talked about the second renaissance that is coming, the digital renaissance that has arrived with creators now having the tools, the distribution mechanisms, and new relationships between patrons and creators, enabling this flourishing that we say is similar to Renaissance Italy. So in order to understand the second renaissance, we thought best to actually understand the first renaissance, and no one better to be with us than the Ubaldo Perotti Professor of History at Stanford. So Paula, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Sarah. I'm really happy to be here.
And I, in college, actually studied art history in addition to economics. And I have to say, I did not think that it would intersect with my life as an investor. So a real personal joy for me to have you. And you talked a lot about Renaissance Italy as being the historical laboratory for understanding the possibilities and problems of a potential kind of innovative society. Let's start with the possibilities side of it. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I would point to several key factors. So one is new kinds of patronage, right? The Renaissance is an incredible place to understand the emergence of a variety of different kinds of infrastructures of investment and support for all sorts of creativity. So this is one key thing I mean when I talk about this as a historical laboratory of an innovative society. The other is the role of new technologies, but also techniques, right? New ways of making and of doing things as well, and the way that these things come together. And last but hardly least, I would also want to point to what happens to attitudes towards artists and the arts. You know, one of the things we generally say about the Renaissance is it's a period in which the artist is no longer seen only as a maker, but a knower. So how does making become knowing? And what does that do for the society as well as for the arts themselves? And what does it do for artists? So that's one of the reasons I fell in love with the Renaissance years ago, and I've never gotten tired of thinking about this.
Well, I'm curious to understand more about what you mean about that makers versus knowers, because, you know, in the digital analogy, we think about companies like Roblox, where they have really built kind of a metaverse for children of all ages to really be creators. So I'm curious to dig in more. We talk about creators and makers. What's the difference between that and a knower?
Well, so one difference is the environment in which they support. Like when you go to work, how do you see your workplace? So the traditional workplace for an artist, say in the Middle Ages, or even in the early, you know, years of what we call the Renaissance, is what's called the bottega, the shop. So think about what a bottega is. You know, a bottega is, it's not my craft shop where I do projects, you know, and woodworking. I mean, you may be doing those things, but fundamentally a bottega is, it is a commercial workplace, right? It's open to the public. It's a place where you sell things. So the word bottega is one that really, you know, it is essential to understanding where the arts start, right? That these are artisans selling their wares to the public in a public space that is also entirely commercial. One of the things you begin to see is artists talk about the fact that they are now in something they call the studio, right? Our term studio comes from that. When people talk about having a studio, not a bottega, we've actually kept that word all the way to the present day. Isn't that amazing? And it's kind of a legacy of the idea of, so what is a studio? It's similar like to the word study. So a studio instead is a place where, say, teaching can occur. So rather than just hiring somebody on as an apprentice, you actually are teaching them a set of learned skills, right? Not just manual techniques, but something that includes that, but also goes beyond it. And you're also learning, right? The studio is a space of learning. And finally, it is also a space of research, right? The idea that you learn deeply, that new kinds of knowledge come out of it. So the idea of being a knower is very tied to having a studio. And famously, right, you can think of examples of this. Famously, Michelangelo said late in his life that he never had to aprire bottega, to open a workshop, you know, and this was his way of saying that he had always been a painter of a studio, which, you know, when you look at the literal aspects of his life, it's a little disingenuous, but there's enough truth to that. I mean, this is why when he dies, people call him the divine and they sort of make him this transcendent figure, because, you know, he has really sold and lived this kind of new lifestyle of the artist in various ways.
As a lover of art myself, I always think of the studio visit as like the greatest honor to be able to actually interact with an artist. And similarly, it feels like this real collaborative kind of sharing, learning, knowing moment with the viewer and the artist and the real community sense. And that's something I wanted to ask you about as a student of art history. I've always, you know, Western tradition seems to really celebrate the individual artist, you know, like the Leonardo da Vinci and his individual genius. He seems like the original polymath in many ways. But in reality, at least in my observation, it seems like a lot of artists exist in cohorts, right? Like Matisse and Picasso were actually creating at the same time. And you can see, or a Warhol and a Basquiat, their influence in one another's works, to take some contemporary examples. So I'd love to hear any kind of learnings from the Italian Renaissance around kind of agglomerations and cities or cohorts of artists, or like, is there anything we can learn from that historically when we think about the digital future?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, the studio visit definitely goes back to this period. You know, somebody like Michelangelo is not a good example. He didn't really have an open studio, to say the least. But say Raphael in Rome, you know, the young, talented, very social, very connected Raphael he thrived in that kind of open studio culture in many ways. And so, first of all, the myth of the individual artist, of course, always makes invisible the fact that these are collaborative projects. Every artist has a whole bevy of assistants. They are crowdsourcing aspect of the work they do. The whole point of the studio training thing is to multiply the effect, right? How can Raphael be so incredibly productive? You know, he dies very, very young, but he leaves behind hundreds of paintings, hundreds of drawings. Well, he's training. How can Dürer also, like, you know, a German Renaissance artist, how can he multiply his effect? He has trained people to exactly produce his distinctive graphic style. And so one is those kind of collaborations that artists build up in the people around them, and of course, how they learn from the older generation before them. But then the other half of your question too, about how do centers emerge? I mean, this is a great part of studying Renaissance art. So you see these artists kind of in search of the right location, you know, because without the right location, their opportunities for commissions, for patronage, you know, to earn a decent living are very limited. And so that sort of wanderlust, like, you know, I'll take the example of Raphael. He's from Urbino, very interesting small hill town right in central Italy. And he goes to different places, including, say, Florence. But he recognized Florence is a great place for him to learn, right? He could see what Michelangelo was doing, because when he goes there, Michelangelo and Leonardo uniquely are both back in town, which they mostly are not, right? They're mostly not in Florence. He learns there, but I think he also recognizes this is not a place where he's going to have a flourishing career. There's too much competition from people who are well-networked in that place. So instead, Rome for him is a much more open center, as it was for many people in this period. That in Rome, you know, he saw that he could really establish himself, gain patrons in an open market, but also in one where there are all sorts of people coming and going. Think of his School of Athens, where he paints all these painters who come to Rome, including, of course, famously Michelangelo and Leonardo, into the School of Athens. And that's a great demonstration of somebody actually painting aspects of that world that's all concentrating in one particular place for a certain moment. So every Renaissance city, Florence, Rome, Venice, you know, every one of them has their moment when it becomes an international center for the arts. But Rome immediately comes to mind when you're asking me about that kind of, you know, kind of like LA today, right? Or other places we might think of that have become real hubs for contemporary arts. Rome was definitely the Renaissance LA.
Rome is the Renaissance LA. There, somebody should tweet that. What's interesting about that, I'm wondering in the digital Renaissance, whether that can actually be decentralized and distributed, because historically you really had to go to these, you know, you could choose Florence or Rome, but, you know, in the digital world, you could actually connect with artists from Latvia to Tokyo to Caracas, right? And create it digitally together. So I think it'll be an interesting thing to think about is, like, does the place become, and the cohort, is it actually decentralized or is it centralized as it was historically? Very much remains to be seen. One other characteristic of, you know, of the Renaissance, as I understand it, the Italian Renaissance, is really the patron, the role of the Medicis and the other families that set up these kind of patronage models where you needed the economic structure to actually support the kind of burst of creative activity. Could you share a little bit more about kind of maybe the Medicis themselves, that model, and kind of any learnings that could help us when we think about kind of what the second Renaissance may be like?
Yeah, the Medici, of course, are the ultimate Renaissance patrons along with certain popes. I mean, there's one famous moment I have with the scion of the Medici family, you know, the so-called godfather of the Renaissance, Cosimo the Elder, Il Vecchio. And there's a point where somebody asks him, you know, they say, I don't really understand what you're doing. And Cosimo, it is said, looks at him and says, learn my language, right? He's doing something out of the box that people don't understand. He's inventing a whole new role because he's not a hereditary ruler. He doesn't hold public office. You know, he's a banker and a merchant, but somehow he's managed to put his finger on the pulse of his society, you know, to the point that ultimately people do realize he is the most important political figure who has no official role in the city. Hence the popular title in, TV specials that he's the godfather of the Renaissance. But what he is also is he's one of those people who begins to see the value of investing all this capital in the arts and, you know, in architectural commissions. He invests in all sorts of other things. He has a great library, but, you know, he's investing in every aspect of the infrastructure of his society, including culture. I mean, he is contributing to making Florence, you know, the beautiful city that people still like to visit today. And, you know, he doesn't do that alone, of course. He inspires others who also have similar wealth who are less well-known today than he was, but, you know, they're building their big fancy palaces. They're competing to hire, you know, the best architects, the best painters, and so on. And, you know, this is the kind of world that really provides a rich array of opportunities, as well as inspiring a lot of people to do this, you know, a lot of people to hope. So hence the competition is stiff, even with all these interesting, you know, patrons. I mean, I'll pick a different example. Julius II, the famous Renaissance Pope made famous in the agony and the ecstasy, you know, when will you make an end to it, right? Says the Pope to Michelangelo, a la Charlton Heston. And Julius has his portrait painted, I don't know how many times, some amazing number of times. He, even though each one is a unique artifact, it's like the infinite reproducible Pope. I mean, he's using the artist to project himself in all sorts of ways, and increasingly not only in painting and architecture, but also in these new experiments in the age of the printing press, right? The reproducible image. I mean, that becomes more and more important later on, of course, beyond this early period, but that's the starting point. We're in the early age of the printed image and all the graphic experiments that come with that.
Quite interesting when you talk about the godfather of the Renaissance, kind of the merchant acquiring this legitimacy that didn't exist before as a source of power. And again, I just muse about kind of the digital Renaissance and whether that new merchant could actually be, you know, knowers, makers, like artists supporting other artists, right? Like, is that now possible in a way that it wasn't before? Or will we have a similar kind of setup of a Medici equivalent of this Renaissance? And I guess I'm curious to ask was it just the Medicis? Was it many merchants? Like how many families were supporting this whole ecosystem of creatives?
There's a multiplying effect, you know, family, you know, so they're families of different levels. You know, by the time you get to the 17th century Netherlands, right, private ownership of paintings goes down, you know, many, many households in a city like Amsterdam would have owned a painting. So now we're at a whole new level of diffusion. But even in this world, I mean, you know, the church invests in art. businesses invest in art. That's the old patronage model, is to have corporate investment in art. But now, you know, we have the individual patron as well, but it's not like the corporate model goes away. And you also have, interestingly, you begin to have artists who think about how to maybe opt out of being under the control of the patron, you know, like Durer. That's one of the reasons he gets so invested in doing prints, is that if he can create this distinctive graphic style with perfectly reproducible images, he might be able to have an aspect of his life that really is in his own control, because he's come up with a new economic model. Even Raphael, interestingly, does a bit of that. You know, he's got this stipend from the Pope and it's quite generous, but then he says, the rest of my time is my own. And he starts working with collaborators, with other artists who can turn his images into engravings. And they continue to sell the Raphael brand after his death, right? Because it's their business as much as his. So you definitely see an evolution, even within the Renaissance, of people's idea of what the model is. So first you have these corporate patrons, then you have the individual patron like Cosimo de' Medici, but you definitely start to see the artist entrepreneur emerging as well.
I was going to say, that's what, honestly, I'm learning listening to you, is like that their creation is aesthetic, but also in an economic kind of business model as well. That those are, we often think of them as separate people, but in many of these figures, they're one and the same. And I'm curious, you had also alluded to, and some of our conversations, kind of J.P. Morgan and the Gilded Age in America as maybe an intermediate step between the Italian Renaissance and our digital Renaissance. Is that a similar dynamic or a different one?
I think they saw the similarities. You know, people like Morgan, there's a reason that the Pierpont Morgan Library is filled with medieval and Renaissance works, that many of these, you know, the big businessmen of the Gilded Age saw themselves as the new Medici. And therefore they, as a way of expressing it, they collected Renaissance art and also modeled themselves on what they thought they understood about patrons, because, you know, they're taking trips to Italy. So we owe a lot of the wonderful collections of Renaissance art in, say in North America, to that Gilded Age love of the Renaissance. Now, of course, they were patrons in an industrial age, in a world of steamships that made that possible, of new technologies of transportation and communication, of new business models as well, right? What is the model for it? So yeah, I agree with you that it's a kind of interesting intermediate between today and the Renaissance to think about a moment like the Gilded Age and the way in which it also starts to invest in, you know, say most of our modern museums, like the Metropolitan Museum. You know, museums in the US are a product of the 1870s, 80s onward. And that's exactly that moment. It is exactly those patrons who decide we should all be able to go to the museum while they're also developing their own private collections at home.
I don't know what I would do in my private time if not for these museums. But Paul, I'm curious your view of kind of some of the problems that artists and creators faced back in the Italian Renaissance that, you know, we may be able to learn from, that kind of, we've talked about many of the positive parallels, but what are some of the challenges we should be mindful of?
So one always was finding a stable source of funding. You know, they're enormous competition. Patrons come and go. What if the Pope dies? What if you're out of favor? And so, for instance, a young Andrea Mantegna, you know, one of the great Renaissance artists of an earlier generation than, say, Leonardo and Michelangelo and Raphael, when he's young, you know, people describe him. At one point, one of his contemporaries says he's continually burned by the sting of poverty. So he has to solve that problem. And eventually he does. He finds the right patron. Fortunately, the patron is long-lived. But I think he's always aware of how precarious it is. And this is also kind of Durer's response when he leaves his, you know, the world of Renaissance Germany, and he comes to Venice, and he writes to a friend back there, and he says, you know, here I'm a gentleman. At home, I'm a parasite, right? He feels free, and yet he goes back home, and he's got to figure it out anyway. So that we always have to figure it out. You never know where the next commission is. Great, great challenge, right, for Renaissance artists. Another challenge, I think, was getting people to invest in the more experimental aspects of what they did. That's like Leonardo's problem, right? The guy who hardly ever finishes a painting, even though they're awesome. I mean, everything for him is an endless experiment. How to get people to invest in the experiment, to see the value of the experiment, you know, that's another problem, right, too, that they never fully solve, but they keep trying. And Then I think maybe the final one I'll mention is overcoming the limits even of new technologies. So for instance, in one of the manuals written in the middle of the 16th century, advising people on how to be a great, you know, work with gold, work with metals, you know, be a great goldsmith, a great sculptor. The author of this, a guy named Biranguccio, says, design is the key that opens the doors. But, right, it opens the doors. It doesn't mean it solves all the problems, right? Design thinking is all over the Renaissance, and it's a great example of that kind of experimental flexibility, right? Of it's not just about drawing, which is the original origins, right? A disegno is something you draw, but it's also something you make, and you can make it in different forms. But, you know, for instance, for Leonardo, the printed image, he never goes into print. And it's not because he doesn't think about it. I think he thinks about it intensely. But he's never satisfied that the current state of that technology in producing a woodcut, an engraving, an etching will do for him what he really wants, which is basically an almost three-dimensional, animated, stereoscopic image. You know, he would have loved the digital possibilities today, because that's what I think he was hoping to do, say, with his anatomical drawings, or with the drawings he does for a book on divine proportion, where he does these wonderful, you know, polygons and different kinds of geometric images. And he's trying to do things with a technology that's still very limited. You know, so the best artists are pushing against the limits of technology. And in doing so, sometimes they innovate, and other times, like Leonardo, they just never get there.
Imagine what we would have had if Leonardo had the tools that we have in front of us today. Well, Paula, in talking to you, one of the things that's really stood out to me is like your delight in this period of history and your desire, it seems, to almost go back and be with these characters. And I do wonder whether in the future, like somebody will talk about kind of this era of digital Renaissance and say like, oh, if only they had the tools we had today. And to be around some of the great entrepreneurs and artists, which I couldn't agree more, actually. One and the same. So Paula, thank you very much. And to many, many more Renaissance to come.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much, Sarah.